three,
nuclear power
two,
plant here in London.
One. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your host, Luke Kim, and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Ballad of American Skeletons, or American Ballad of Skeletons. Said the presidential skeleton, "I won't sign the bill." Said the speaker skeleton, "Yes, you will." Said the representative skeleton, "I object." Said the Supreme Court skeleton, "What do you expect?" Said the military skeleton, "Buy star bombs." Said the upper class skeleton, "Starve unmarried moms." Said the Yahoo skeleton, "Stop dirty art." Said the right wing skeleton, "Forget about your heart." Said the Gnostic skeleton, "The human form's divine." Said the moral majority skeleton, "No, it's not, it's mine." Said the Buddha skeleton, "Compassion is wealth." Said the corporate skeleton, "It's bad for your health." Said the old Christ skeleton, "Care for the poor." Said the Son of God skeleton, "AIDS needs cure." Said the homophobe skeleton, "Gay folks suck." Said the heritage policy skeleton, "Blacks are out of luck." Said the macho skeleton, "Women in their place." Said the fundamentalist skeleton, "Increase the human race." Said the right to life skeleton, "Fetus has a soul." Said the pro-choice skeleton, "Shut it up your hole." Said the downsized skeleton, "Robots got my job." Said the tough on crime skeleton, "Tear gas the mob." Said the governor's skeleton, "Cut school lunch." Said the mayor's skeleton, "Eat the budget crunch." Said the neocon skeleton, "Free markets the way." Said the savings and loan skeleton, "Make the state pay." Said the Chrysler skeleton, "Pay for you and me." Said the nuke power skeleton, "And me and me and me."
That was Allen Ginsberg, The Ballad of the Skeletons. Welcome once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your anarchist radio show on the internet. And we have, once again, a guest, our co-host, Eric. Are you there, Eric?
I'm here. Good to talk to you again, Jonathan.
How's your week been?
It's like most, it's a bit of a struggle, but I'm holding my head high and going to the fight every day.
Nice, nice. Well, I guess some interesting things happening this last week. I'm sure you've heard about the normal stuff happening. More people killed in Pakistan. Apparently, Obama has decided to increase some 45,000 troops, sent 45,000 more troops to the Middle East, I think to Afghanistan, and the House has just approved a new sanctions against Iran. In Israel, we continue to hear about home demolitions in East Jerusalem. So, doesn't look like the world's getting any better, does it?
Well, at least he got a Pulitzer, a Nobel Peace Prize for his actions. So
that's right. I guess we didn't talk. We didn't get to talk about that. You know, I actually made a video on YouTube making fun of that, where I had, you know, people calling me on different phones, and you know, and I basically was ordering a shipment of bombs over here or troops over there, and then the last phone call was the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, you know, and I got awarded the prize for my contribution to, you know. So, yeah, I mean, what was your immediate reaction? I mean, this is not the first time that happens, right? I mean, we had people like Kissinger and other notable figures like that getting that kind of prize.
Well, that's very true. I had an initial impression that they were awarding it to him as to pressure him into doing the right thing.
Right.
But in doing a little more research on it and hearing the commission that actually awards the prize, their explanation of it was that they really truly were buying into Obama as a sort of a peacemaker around the world. It was, I think it was on Democracy Now. I'd have to go find the footage, but it was an interview with the people who actually award the prize. I think that this prize is greatly overrated, if that was the reaction of their of that committee.
Well, I mean,
again, you said it was awarded to Kissinger.
right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought the same thing as you. I thought, well, maybe it'll be a good thing because it'll restrain the criminality of the current administration. You know, it'll constrain it. But you know, thinking about it twice, I also thought, well, it may actually condone some of these actions, because I mean, now obviously Obama's actually sending more troops, doing some of the same things. You know, the killings continue, drone attacks, civilian deaths. So it seems to me that's just going to legitimize and condone all those actions, rather than, you know, constrain so much. You know,
that's very true. It's made a mockery of a prize that has been treasured by so many people. But hopefully this will be just a blip on the chart, like the Kissinger thing, that some confused people up in there on the commission, or maybe some people who were in the pay. I don't know. I don't want to go all conspiracy theory on it, but
right.
Clearly they ran the prize into a ditch this year, and hopefully they will see with clearer eyes next year.
Yeah. Well, I guess the healthcare debate continues. I mean, we've been going through the same sort of conundrum for over and over again for the past few months, that this public option is not even going to be on the table. And in the
even
meantime,
the public option wasn't that good.
Right. I mean, you know, and now everyone's conceding that, you know, this is typical. You have a very aggressive right wing, and then you have a sort of a weak-kneed center-left sort of coalition that, you know, starts, you know, like they've all admitted, they started with the compromise. Well, you know, they say, okay, we'll go for the public option rather than going for single-payer healthcare. And, you know, they haven't gotten far at all. I mean, it's pretty ominous. Have you followed any of that, or?
I've been following it, but just the general contours of it. I get caught up in the detail of it. The overall, to me, it seems without the single payer policy, it's just another system. Even with the public option, it still is a you've got a method to pump more tax dollars into the pockets of the insurance companies. And what they've got now is a method to force you to purchase health insurance, and maybe it will be subsidized by the government, but that's still your tax dollars. I've seen some of the commercials on TV that insurance companies say, you don't want the government coming between you and your doctor. I say, look, I don't want the insurance company coming between me and my doctor, okay? Because
yeah.
Ostensibly, the government is not a for-profit organization. We can vote ostensibly, vote people in and out of the government. Not the same, you know. I would much rather have a friendly face there at between me and my doctor, and instead of a rapacious wolf in between me and my doctor.
That sort of echoes the some of the propaganda we've heard about the financial sector, which is anyone who's taken an economy class knows that it's the financial sector is considered a middleman between between, you know, different sectors of industry. And that middleman tells you, well, you don't want the government to be your middleman. But of course, the assumption is they are the middleman. Now, we're getting a question here from the chat room, and they're asking what an ideal healthcare system would be like. I know this is from Charnchi. What an ideal healthcare libertarian socialist healthcare would look like. Well, I mean, yeah. If you want to put forth an ideal sort of model, I mean, ideally you would have a sort of a gift economy in that regard. It would be considered a human right. You would have healthcare institutions, collectives that take care of people, and you probably wouldn't have if healthcare was in any way centralized. It wouldn't be centralized in the it wouldn't. The control would be more in the form of sort of like the rest of industry, you know. So you would have a sort of a federated model with worker councils, consumer councils, sort of, and at every sort of level, you know, the general assemblies and federations and so on. You would have sort of a bottom up democracy. And that, you know, so that would be it. So whether it was centralized or not centralized, I mean, like we do know in economics, this I'm sure you've heard about this, Eric, is something called a natural monopoly. So certain services,
yes,
end up being more efficient, if you know, like electricity, water, if they are centralized. So the word centralized has sort of a bad connotation. Oh, you know, you're gonna give the power to a few people, but it doesn't have to be that way. Like, if you want, say, one central industry making a lot of something, you know, a lot of bottles or a lot of, you know, whatever it is, I don't think there's a conflict between democracy and centralization in terms of democratic production. That is, the industries will be democratically controlled, and that would include healthcare. So healthcare may be more effectively run in a centralized fashion. Maybe not. Maybe there will be more sort of collectives. But you know, all of this is sort of like far off in the future. And but for right now, a worthy goal would be democratizing the state and trying to achieve a single payer solution, and you know, right now we can't even get the public option. So
exactly, the exact details of how it would work, how centralized it would be versus, you know, exact tax rates, who's all of those are details we can kind of leave behind at this point, because really the 800 pound gorilla in the room is that the insurance companies are getting what they want, and so that's the really huge war. I had a couple of interesting testimonies from people who grew up in other countries and their health programs, and these are people that are very close to me. If I could share them with you, their reaction to my fiance grew up in the Soviet Union, and while she will rail on and on against many of the abuses of the Soviet Union, things that have happened there, the one thing that she and her Russian colleagues here in America are flabbergasted by is the healthcare system. The idea that, for example, in the Soviet Union, if you had a child, you were required to stay in that hospital for 1 week, no matter how good it turned out. If you got sick, you went to the doctor. That's all you did. You went to the doctor. Her father is a pediatrician. She knows the system. Okay, there are a lot of a lot of issues. This is not saying the Soviet Union's the way to go or anything, but just to contrast that system that we criticize so very much and how much better the healthcare system was. The second person that I spoke to this week is from Sweden. I call her about once a week, and she's never lived anywhere but Sweden, even though she can speak English very well. She had to ask me, what do you mean health insurance? I said, it's like sort of like car insurance. Okay, I understand that part. But for your health, you mean you have to pay for health care? Well, what do you do in Sweden? We go to the doctor. We just go to the doctor. We don't think about it. You mean you have to pay money? She was saying to me, you have to pay money to be covered, and some people are not covered. She was flabbergasted by this concept.
I may add that a typical argument that is leveled against proponents of public health care by, for example, the free marketeers, they say, well, we shouldn't have what they call unchosen obligations toward other people. That is, if you have a system in which you have to, you're part of a society in which you're forced to give money to provide healthcare for other people. That
understood.
Yeah. Now, but the argument against that is that unchosen obligations exist in any society, whether you want to call them that or not. So, for example, what we call wage slavery, having to rent yourself to a boss under threat of, you know, starvation, poverty, social stigma, etc. That is the framework of that is unchosen. That is, it's not like, say, self-managing the economy, the workplace, having a system in which we as a community decide how to allocate resources, which would mean effectively that we would ensure at the very least these basic things like healthcare, like shelter, clothing, etc., etc. So if you say, well, I don't want any, I don't want to be obliged to be part of a community and abide by the rules, abide by the principles that would be in place, then you're just choosing a different form of oppression. So some compromises need to be made, because it's sort of like if you live in a collective, let's say you live in a collective, right? And and you say, well, okay, in order to live here, we all got to wash the dishes once a week, right? And this a person that says, look, well, I don't want to be obliged to wash the dishes. I don't want that's an infringement upon my freedom. But the problem is that if you live in that collective, you know, it's nice because you don't have you're not being exploited by a boss. You share their resources and all, but you have to do your part, you know, and so there's got to be some sort of compromise. And people would say, well, I just don't want to be oppressed that way. Well, what's the alternative? That's I think the question.
Exactly. We already have this sort of odious debt thrust upon us by these wars, these bailouts, and things like this. How is that any different from you being forced to cover somebody else's program? It's interesting how these a more public, a kinder healthcare system is criticized for being an odious burden placed upon other people's shoulders. Well, how the heck do we feel every day when we know our tax dollars are going to murder people around the world in Afghanistan and Ethiopia and the dirty little war in Somalia that nobody talks about? Yeah, we carry that load too.
Right.
It's
not
as if this is something new.
The understanding of the word tax in our society is, you know, somebody who comes to you and takes away your hard-earned money. But if you, you know, capitalism is all about taking the money that you earned, and not only the money, also the democratic say, taking that away, and putting that mm-hmm. into the into a certain class of people who control and own the society. So we don't call
exactly.
that tax. We don't call that. But if we try, say, through the to democratize the state and say implement progressive taxation, which would not exist in a libertarian socialist society, because you wouldn't have a capitalist class to progressively tax. So, but I'm saying in that current society, that would be a democratic step to implement progressive taxation, to try to get back some of what was stolen from us. Because after all, it was. I mean, when you see these people who work long hours and they get paid minimum wage or barely above it, and then you see these other investors, CEOs, etc., who get paid millions of dollars, you know, that's a misallocation. And, you know, we don't call that
taxes. It
certainly
is.
So, yeah. Well,
right. Resource allocation question. I mean, we don't have to use the word tax. That's probably not even the best word to use.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, I was adopting the terms because for them, sort of like the word tax is tantamount to theft. It's like they can't see it as a way for the people to implement some sort of participatory mechanism or democratic control over the government. They can't conceive of something mm-hmm. like that. So they have to accept an exploitative framework and assume that you know, the capitalist market framework, and then, you know, that just by virtue of you know, just by saying it, it's it becomes legitimate. So it's kind of an ideology that needs to be challenged over and over again because it's so pervasive, equating
exactly.
voluntarism with a capitalism. So, but yeah, you know, I guess going back to you, what you were talking about in Sweden, they have a, you know, even those countries which do not approximate, you know, our ideal as a libertarian socialist, nevertheless do have a very you know, some very positive features in their structure. So I think it would be good to go in that direction. Yeah.
Right. It's not ideal, but it's interesting to compare the absurd rhetoric that's going on in here in the United States, where they threaten us with this Orwellian dystopia called Sweden. I talk
right.
to people over there and they say, no problem. Some of the benefits of social medicine are the lack, the reduction in stress. You don't have to worry all the time that you're going to fall ill and go broke and be thrown out on the street. If you need education, you go to school. And again, that's just Sweden. Those are a couple of aspects of their system that I heartily support. You know, the improvement in quality of life by removing those stressors is just—it's not something you can quantify easily, but is should be readily obvious to everyone.
Yeah. So anyway, is there any world news that you've looked at this past week that you thought was interesting?
Well, we're watching what's going on in Honduras. There's some news that's going to break there. There's apparently been some kind of agreement there, but we can cover that in another show. That's a real important important thing. There's some, if I can bring up some local news here, but I think it is applicable to on a global basis. Here in the state of Maryland, where I live, we're having thrust upon us the first nuclear reactor constructed in the United States since the 1970s. $15 billion nuclear reactor. They laid the groundwork very well for this thing by raising the electricity rates. Doubling them, or I don't know the exact figures, they have so raised electricity rates here in Maryland that they almost have people asking for this thing. Now, it's a sweet deal for the Constellation Energy as a company, and it's doing a partnership with a French company called Electricity of France. It includes a $33 million golden parachute for the CEO. This is just this kind of centralized corporate control over such basic commodities as electricity is a structural problem that that we need to address.
You know,
this
is a way. Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, when I lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I was there for about 3 months when I was 20 years old, and I remember that I'd never had this problem because I had never really rented an apartment. I rented rooms and stuff, so I didn't have to worry about paying the electricity bill. But when I went to Tulsa, I remember that I forgot to pay the bill, and then all of a sudden I had no lights. You know, they went off, and I was in the total dark, and you know, I was like, damn, like. And then I had to go on my bike to somewhere really far away to pay for it. And so it was like, yeah, I mean, you sort of tend to forget that you don't pay the electricity bill, that, you know, you're you'll be left in the dark.
Right. A lot of people have been cut off. This summer, I was part in some demonstrations down at the electricity company offices in Washington, D.C., and we brought with us, it was another organization, but I partook in it, and they had brought some people who were having their electricity cut off, and people had insulin in the refrigerator, elderly people who were going to die if their air conditioner wouldn't work. Now, I use next to no electricity. No matter what prices they throw at me, my electricity bill still runs $10 a month or so, because I don't use very much. That's one weapon we do have, is to cut back on our consumption. But still, for someone who's ill, someone who has to keep medicine in the refrigerator, it's a death sentence to cut off their electricity. This company has shown itself to be heartless. But this is part of their plan, to my way of thinking. Part of their plan, by jacking up these prices for the traditional oil-fired plants that they're using now and the older nuclear power plants that they're using, to get people not to just accept this new nuclear power plant, but to ask for it. And they've done a lot of greenwashing, too, a lot of astroturfing. I called up the Maryland League of Conservation Voters. Okay, that's stalwart. You know, you think of your League of Conservation Voters and their scorecard that they do every year. Every state has got one, and there's a National League of Conservation Voters. I asked them what was their, the Maryland League of Conservation Voters for their position on this power plant going in, and they had to go to the back office and get the answer and come back and said, they don't have a position on this. This is the League of Conservation Voters, your environmental lobby. I told them back, I said, I wish, as an environmentalist here in Maryland, that I had that luxury. I don't know who to turn to.
Anyway, we have a question or a comment on the chat room that they want us to respond to. Some capitalist apologists were saying, quote, utopian socialism has never worked. At least in capitalism, you can move up the ladder. Well, how can I answer that? First of all, the concept of moving up the ladder or having social mobility doesn't justify a system. So, for example, in colonial Brazil, slaves could actually buy their own freedom and then become self-employed business owners or even slave owners themselves. Now, that didn't justify slavery. So, similarly, it doesn't justify wage slavery, which is similar to chattel slavery, in that you have to work for a boss or else, okay? Now, it's true. In wage slavery, you can indeed choose bosses sometimes, and because we've been struggling for a few hundred years now, a wage laborer in some countries is better off than, say, in 18th century England or 19th century America. So we're not as bad off as we were at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. But nevertheless, the similarities in terms of subordination and exploitation are still there. So now, as far as never working, I think it depends what you mean by socialism. If you mean what the leaders claimed, what some of the leaders claimed was socialism, then you would have to say the same thing about freedom and peace, because Hitler talked about freedom and peace, right? So would we say therefore that we should reject freedom and peace because they lead to the deaths of 6 million Jews in gas chambers? No, just because Hitler said freedom and peace, he doesn't mean it's true. Similarly, because certain leaders spoke about socialism, you know, leaders, dictators like Stalin and others, it doesn't mean it's true. So that's what we have to understand. And, you know, you have had a working class history of people who struggled to gain, you know, to gain freedoms, to gain improvements. And those were not full-blown socialism all the time, but they did amount to freedom. And you have had a few libertarian socialist revolutions, the most notable of which was in Spain in the 1930s, which did feature a large-scale utopian socialism, collectivization of the means of production and self-management and so on, which was not dictatorial. It was based on participatory democracy. And yeah, it's entirely possible. We don't have to choose between different oppressive systems. We can actually achieve freedom. What do you think about that, Eric?
I agree wholeheartedly. I would like to question I'd like to address the premise of the question of the listener. You can move up the ladder. And I'm not sure what they mean. Does that mean that you can have more money? Because there are many different ways that you can value yourself. I my wealth and my is in my relations and in my friends and in my the satisfaction that I can get on simple pleasures on a day-to-day basis. I don't desire a lot of money. Now, I work very hard and I study hard and I do many things, and I'm usually gainfully employed. But as far as moving up the ladder, I'm not sure that. I mean, if that means that I can get more wealthy, I probably could. But I'm not sure that I want to. That I would want to. I'm not sure everyone wants to. I think the false premise there is that money equals happiness on some plane.
Right. I think it's two things. I mean, the example that I gave earlier about a slave being able in Brazil to move up the ladder was that, number one, yes, you move up the ladder, but that doesn't justify your exploitation once you're up the ladder and the hierarchy and the effects that it causes on the society and the individuals. And it doesn't justify the exploitation of the people who have not gone up the ladder. And secondly, as you say, Eric Fromm, and I recommend the listener to read this book, wrote a book called To Have or To Be. And he basically identifies two important states of being, two psychological states. One is the state of to have, that is to acquire a materialistic state. And the other one is to be, that is to experience, to love, to hate, to this, to, you know, and... All these things, I mean, all of us are somewhere in between, right? But where do you want to go? Mm-hmm. Do you want to go toward the having mode or toward the being mode? And that's the sort of question that he poses. And he, you know, makes a strong case that our society, our industrial society, is based largely on the having mode, not the being mode. And that's, you know, that reflects itself, that results in all kinds of pathologies. So, yeah, I think the money point you made is very, very relevant.
It's
To have or to be. Anyway, so I guess it's about 34 minutes into the show, so I guess we could play the second half of that Ballad of the Skeletons. So here we go. All right.
Okay.
Ecologic skeleton, keep skies blue, said the multinational skeleton, what's it worth to you? Said the NAFTA skeleton, get rich, free trade, said the maquiladora skeleton, sweatshops, low paid. Rich Gap skeleton said, one world. High tech said, the underclass skeleton. Get it in the neck, said the World Bank skeleton. Cut down your trees, said the IMF skeleton. Buy American cheese. Said the underdeveloped skeleton. Sell us rice, send it. Developed nation skeleton said, sell your bones for dice. Said the Ayatollah skeleton, die right or die. Said Joe Stalin skeleton, that's no lie. Petrochemical skeleton, roar bombers roar, said the psychedelic skeleton, smoke a dinosaur. The Nancy skeleton, just say no, said the Rasta skeleton, blow Nancy blow. Said the demagogue skeleton, don't smoke pot, said the alcoholic skeleton. Let your liver rot, said the junkie skeleton. Can we get a fix, said the big brother skeleton. Jail the dirty pricks, said the mirror skeleton. Hey, good looking, said the electric chair skeleton. Hey, what's cooking? The talk show skeleton, fuck you in the face, said the family values skeleton. My family values mace, said the New York Times skeleton. That's not fit to print, said the CIA skeleton. Can't you take a hint? Said the network skeleton, believe my lies, said the advertising skeleton, don't get wise, said the media skeleton, believe you me, said the couch potato skeleton, what, we worry? TV skeleton, eat sound bites, said the newscast skeleton, that's all, good night.
That was it, Allen Ginsberg, Ballad of the Skeletons. So, there we are. You like that song, Eric?
Yeah, it's a good tune. I'll have to find a recording of that.
Did you ever hear that before? It's Allen Ginsberg and Paul McCartney.
I haven't heard that particular recording before, but
that's pretty good.
but I'm not much younger than those two individuals that you mentioned. I should probably go back to the do a little more research on that. So, but yeah, I, I'm quite familiar with the works of Allen Ginsberg, at least his poetry, and certainly Paul McCartney. I remember him on the Ed Sullivan Show, if I'm kind of dating myself there. But
anyway, so we have another comment from the chat room. It says, Tawny the Roofer follows up. He says, it means, when we were talking about social mobility, he says, it means moving up in any area, religious, education, or any area of life. So I guess areas other than the economic area. Well, I guess my answer to that would be that the economic aspect of our lives and the psychological effects of inequality and of course the lack of control that we have over our lives, our productive lives, our economy, which basically has a spillover effect over many other areas, and obviously the authoritarian government and all these other things, basically mean that if you try to improve yourself in other areas, I mean, it's a good thing. I mean, I think that, you know, it's better that, you know, you're not a, say, a wife beater, or you're not an alcoholic, or you're not this and that. But it's sort of like it comes down to not perceiving or not understanding that a lot of the root causes of our problems, whether they are relationships or they are problems related to, say, antidepressants, or, you know, just all these problems that don't appear like they're related to our economic system or whatever, are very often related to the power structure in which we live. So yes, when people say, you know, it's your individual responsibility, you can improve in these areas without addressing the other areas, the economic areas, that's very, very, there's very little truth in that. I think that your personal choices are limited by the possibilities and the options that the system makes easy to pursue. The system makes certain options easier to pursue, so they're pursued, you know, and consumerism, and all these other features that we know about our system, those are there to pursue, and that's why they have such a strong influence, and they have a very deterministic, I mean, not 100%, but they certainly have a determining effect on our behavior. I mean, we know the what the statistics are, so we should not abstract away from the system itself. It's a hard question to answer. What do you think about that, Eric?
Well, yeah, there's certainly things to strive for besides wealth, and the I think the listener was mentioning education and social status and all of these things, and certainly those can be are very worthy efforts and wholeheartedly and in some ways they're perfectly free, and in some ways they are, but they are mechanisms that get in the way of improving your education and improving your social standing. For example, the cost of tuition. Here in Maryland, they've been jacking up the price of tuition. And you can say, yeah, I can work full-time, like I did, work full-time, go to school full-time. But, you know, you're not going to do so well in school like that. So there's that. It's not as simple as just improving your education because you want to improve your education. That old class struggle enters back into there, and the same sort of goes along with the social standing. And yes, there's always that guy. There's that Bill Gates guy, or there's that, you know, somebody who rose from your old Horatio Alger stories. Someone who rose from nothing and now he's the president of the United States. But, you know, chances are much better if you have a wealthy family, can go to Harvard, you're going to be much better connected at age 22 or 25 whenever you get out. So the structures still are there. And yes, they can be overcome, but they're much more difficult to overcome if you come from a humble background. And I think our goal should be to see those see an equality of opportunity in those areas, not just in earning capacity, but in social capacity and access to government and education, all of these things.
I may remind the listener that we embrace the value of classlessness. We think that it's a very important value, and so the chance to get ahead in a class society cannot be equated with the results of a classless society. A classless society delivers a happiness, a deep happiness that is not that is different from the kind of happiness you get when you get rich and when you get and that's the thing that you have to ask yourself. See, one of the things that we don't ask ourselves is, when I become, a successful business owner, successful investor, is my success not dependent on the wage slavery of other people? Am I not sort of extracting from there not only their wealth but also their decision-making power, their democratic say over the economy? Am I not taking away from that, you see? So what is defined as success? Like, for example, if I go back to the example I gave earlier, if I was a slave and I bought my own freedom and became a slave owner, yeah, I've succeeded. Yeah, in some sense, I've succeeded. I'm no longer a slave. Now I'm a slave owner. But, you know, is that moral?
Exactly.
That a moral thing, you know? I think that we've already answered that thoroughly. So, I guess this has been a lot of talk about depoliticization. And there was just a book, very interesting book, that was, I don't know if you watched Democracy Now! Yesterday, Eric, but Barbara Ehrenreich talking about this positive thinking industry and how it's sort of a substitute or veneer for some of the problems, some of the deeper institutional problems that we face. Sort of like you got to feel good about everything, and you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So
I remember that very well now.
Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on that?
Sorry to interrupt.
No. As I'm saying that I think that you probably have seen sort of the rise of this positive thinking movement where you get people like Tony Robbins and others who of course get very wealthy in the process of selling you all these self help tapes and stuff, because I mean my idea is that there is a place for building certain psychological habits or changing your habits, but not when it's at the expense of changing the root cause of our problems, which is the system itself. And it seems that these self-help or these positive thinking paradigms, whether it's New Age or it's mega church stuff or be all you can be, a power to the self and all that stuff, that sort of plays into the system and reinforces the system, right?
Well, yes, I couldn't agree more with that. That's what it does is it tries to that kind of positive thinking. I don't want to say I want to define that term, the positive thinking that the woman, and I'm looking up her name right now, is the author of that book. When she was talking about this positive thinking movement, it was a pernicious kind of positive thinking, where it was a reality denying positive thinking.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
it's,
Yeah, as I'm saying, that it basically takes away from the real spiritual transformation that would occur in changing the system and the institutions and or struggling in that direction, changes that for a superficial sort of happiness, superficial. Habit of just always looking at things in a positive manner, even if it's not realistic or beneficial to do so. I think that was the argument, in some sense.
Barbara Ehrenreich. Was refreshing to yeah. Yeah, that's the name, Barbara Ehrenreich. I'm going to buy that book, I think, myself. But it was really a rather audacious thing to come out and say. You know, this positive thinking is a bunch of hooey. She gave specific examples. She was suffering from breast cancer herself, and she was saying, like, yeah, it was as if the happy, you know, the happy brigade came by and they gave me a pink teddy bear, and even insinuated that to have this breast cancer was a blessing of some kind. You're in the club now, and you can partake in all of our activities. It was a little bit disturbing from a cultural standpoint. Rather than focusing on how do I fix this and what caused this, what's wrong with my health care? I've got all these health care problems. You know, she gets a pink teddy bear. I would urge.
Yep. Go ahead.
I'd urge our listeners to take a look at the Democracy Now! Website and check out yesterday's interview with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting. Anyways, Eric, we have a question for you from J.R. Pick. He says, what do you think of the different generations of activists from your generation to younger kids, I guess, today's generation?
Huh. Well, it's interesting. I was a little bit of a betweener in terms of war protesting. I was a little bit too young for the Vietnam War. I was aware of what was going on, but what's the difference? You know, let me see. One thing, and I think Chomsky would back me up on this, is that the Vietnam War had been going on for decades before people started to really take to the streets in the 60s, 66, 67, 68, when you started seeing the act on your television set, seeing people blown to bits and burned to a crisp on your TV set. But remember, it had gone on without any serious out in the street type of demonstrations for decades beforehand. If you listen to the 1960 Nixon Kennedy debates, you'll see how they're trying to outdo each other on who can be the biggest foe of communism. What's different now is that before that Iraq War got started, people were out in the streets, so in ways that people were far more active this time than they were at that time. And it's unprecedented in American history that people would be out in the streets in the hundreds of thousands. I live here in a close-in suburb to Washington, D.C. You had 100, 200, 300, 400,000 people on some weekends out there to protest. This was before they had launched the actual invasion in March 2003. One thing that's been very disappointing, and I'm not sure that this is a distinction between the movement of that former generation and this generation, but it seems to have kind of dissipated. Part of that was to paint a smiley face on it. You got Barack Obama in there now, and he's not George Bush. That's his, I think, his biggest appeal. So a lot of the anti-war movement has sort of faded away, even though there are some very, very strong activists. If you I could name a lot of names right now, but I think they're pretty well known to folks. Sometimes with these movements are difficult to sustain, and that's the shame. These movements are hard work, and they're not easy, and they carry risk, and they take a long, long time. So that's not for everyone, I think.
I guess tying our conversation earlier about the positive thinking movement with the sort of improvements in terms of activism, one could actually mention 9/11 as an event that would, in fact, share some of the characteristics, the features that we're always told by these positive thinking people that, you know, something that's bad can actually bring about good results. I mean, that's certainly good. That's certainly true. That can often happen. We got to analyze the reasons, and the reasons may be very complex. And with 9/11, what was pointed out by Chomsky and others is that it elicited a lot of response, a lot of questioning about, you know, why do they hate us? You know, how come they attacked us? Don't we do good around the world? And so it caused me to start questioning the system, and it ultimately made me an activist. It made me into the person that I am today, and I think a lot of people would say the same thing. So some of these events, catalytic events, have that effect, and I think 9/11 was a source of activism, but yeah, I would have to agree with you that that a lot of the liberal protesters have been subdued by the Obama election. And I mean, we have now even, I don't know if you heard just what some of our other shows, but Code Pink was actually coming out in favor of the occupation of Afghanistan.
Yes, from what I understand, and I'll have to look at it, I'll go through with a finer tooth comb, that was quite a disappointment. Occupation is an occupation, and to imagine the United States in a role of do-gooder in any corner of the earth is just laughable. It's just laughable given our history.
And the thing is that they were not considering the opinion of the Afghani people. They said, well, they took the testimony of someone in the government there, which is basically a puppet government, and does not represent the will of the people. And you know, as far as we know, the polls in Iraq, Afghanistan, all these countries indicate that yes, the people want they don't want to be occupied. So it should be about them.
It's very true. The situation in Afghanistan is disturbing. I'm certainly no fan of the Taliban. Even though, as a footnote, we should say that the Taliban was called the Mujahideen when I was younger in the 1980s, and it was bankrolled first by Jimmy Carter in response to the Soviet invasion of 1979, and then picked up wholeheartedly by the
90 seconds.
By the Reagan administration. Now, that's in the context of the Cold War. It's, you know, so that complicates it a little bit. But Mujahideen, Taliban, whatever you want to call them, this was a term exaltation of honor. People named their pets Mujahideen in the 1980s. I don't know if the word Taliban was in common use back then. But still, the Taliban's not a good thing, but it's hard to imagine. Imagine if Taliban was over here in America to civilize us. Okay, how you'd feel about having someone from another country speaking, doesn't even speak your language, but he's here to patronize you and bring civilization to you. Yes, there's going to be a backlash on that. Whether you're right or whether you're wrong, you're going to hate that son of a bitch who is
right,
telling you what to do.
And it's up to them to liberate themselves, and it's, and we shouldn't have any illusions about what the intentions and the role of government is in the world. So with that note, I guess we're going to finish with the song Muse by the group Uprising. Thank you very much for being here, Eric, and I guess we'll see you next week.
Jonathan, it's always a privilege and pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Muse by Uprising. Good night. I'm